Being an early stage investor has really validated for me how asking the right questions the right way at the right time can often be more a determinant of your success than being the person to raise their hand and come up with the answer, which of course is the exact opposite of what we're taught, at least in the education process in this country, which is, think about it, from our earliest years in the schools, we're taught, give an answer, get an A, not ask a question, get an A. And so it's validated that the question can have a bigger impact on success and failure. Now, I'm working on so many things where I don't really know the answers. It's my ability to ask questions and puzzle things through that gets me to the answers.
After that clip, you know the rest is going to be good. Please take 2 seconds to click the follow or subscribe button on your podcast player. You can set it once and forget tracking down each weekly episode. This makes your life easier and signals to the algorithms that the show should be recommended to other listeners. A simple act that can have an outsized positive impact on others. Now, let's get to it. Albert Einstein said, "Don't think about why you question, simply don't stop questioning." Welcome to Curated Questions. I am your host, Ken Woodward. And these questions are not mathematical equations, but rather a resource to encounter personal reflection and growth. As Tupac Shakur stated, even the genius asks questions. Now, let's engage the questioning community. Greetings. Ken Woodward here. Welcome back to another episode of Curated Questions. Together, we engage inquisitive humans about how they use questions to navigate and make sense of our world. I am a fellow traveler and pilgrim on this journey, and I'm glad you are here. Today's conversation is with Amy Radin. Amy's approach began in her father's neighborhood drugstore, where success depended on understanding diverse customers and creating experiences worth returning for. That foundation of inquiry-driven problem-solving would propel her to become one of the world's first corporate chief innovation officers at Citi long before innovation became a standard title. Amy has held senior roles at American Express, E-Trade, AXA, now Equitable, and is a board member of the Association of International Certified Professional Accountants. She currently teaches strategic advocacy at the Master of Science Technology Management program at Columbia University. As the award-winning author of The Changemaker's Playbook, Amy has spent decades proving that when your ability to put food on the table depends on genuinely serving people, you develop clarity about what matters versus just what sounds good in a meeting. Her questioning methodology helps revolutionize industries, from developing online portals that become industry standard practice for loan collections to advising Fortune 500 companies on AI implementation. What makes Amy's story compelling isn't just her corporate achievements, which are significant, but how she systematically codified the power of strategic questioning. Working at the intersection of established industries and emerging technologies, she recognized that traditional change approaches were increasingly inadequate for today's challenges. Her solution? A methodology that transforms resistance into momentum by asking the questions others miss. Amy, welcome to Curated Questions.
So great to be here, Ken. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I always like to start at the same point, just to level set folks for the conversation. When did you first understand the power of questions?
It's funny. I grew up in a big family. I'm the middle of 5 children. And we were, I guess, a very curious bunch and had pretty active dinner time discussions. And my parents really encouraged, or I would say maybe pushed us all academically. And so you have an intense focus on academics, and questioning is such an important part of learning that I think it probably was bred into me very early. And then fast forward to the corporate world, as I was thinking about our conversation today, back to some of my corporate experiences, I always ask a lot of questions in meetings. And I think sometimes to the annoyance of my colleagues, where business has become so transactional and people, we're just so conditioned to jump to solutions that asking questions can come across as a slowdown, can come across as you're trying to impede what I'm trying to do. People get defensive about questions. So I think really in the corporate world, I started to realize like, wow, I ask a lot of questions. Then I'll tell you one more pivotal time for me was a few years ago, I became a limited partner in an early stage fund. And the ability to ask the right questions of a founder, whether it's in the pitch session where you decided to go forward or when you're in the middle of due diligence, can make the difference between doing really well or wasting your investment. So it's really critical because you're putting your money on the table to be very specific about the kinds of questions you're asking and to really get founders to open up so you can understand their assumptions, how they're thinking about the market, and how much confidence you have in them.
Boy, all these different trails that I want to follow through on that history, that early stage investor really got a lot of questions.
Yeah,
about
it's interesting.
That.
And as you can see from my answer, my path has been anything but linear.
Yeah. Appreciate many aspects of that as well, right? Because that certainly gives hope for folks that may not have had a linear path, or as they look into that murky future and they desire a linear path because they want to be able to ring the bell, if you will, your path offers some hope that says, all right, just keep working hard and doing the right things, if you will, and then whatever it's going to turn out to be.
It raises a really important point that I think too many people foreclose career options that are not obvious because they're operating on assumptions of what they should do. Versus you could be presented with a very unusual opportunity. And instead of saying, no, that's not me, ask a question and learn more. And actually, that was the beginning of my path to becoming an early stage investor. When I was networking after I left the corporate world to try to decide, what am I going to do with myself now? Because I knew I wasn't going back. A founder suggested that I get engaged in early stage investing. And my first question was, well, what's that? It was so far afield from somebody who's been on the path up the ladder in the corporate world for decades. And so the willingness to explore it and ask questions really opened up a whole new path in my career.
Let's just have some fun with that and kind of cover down since we've got the curiosity brewing right now. You mentioned the specific questions to be able to really understand the founder of these companies. What has that looked like for you? And what was your entry point for some of those questions that you either may have used the specific questions, but also just what fed that curiosity and your assumptions to be able to dig down and figure out what were some of those right questions to be able to get a little bit deeper?
Right. Well, a little bit of context about the fund that I am a member of. It's called Soundboard Venture Fund. And we do not have a specific industry focus. We basically invest in founders. And our thesis is that great innovations don't only arise out of certain zip codes, they're every place. Mm-hmm. So we deliberately stay away from, in general, Boston, New York, the Valley, because we think we have better valuations and some really great founder talent that don't get enough attention every place else in the country. Mm-hmm. So with that said, you know, we invest in lots of things for which I certainly do not have the technical in-depth understanding. You know, we're in agribusiness, we're in AI, we're in prop tech, you know, you name it, we're there. And so the key to really understanding when you're not going to master the sector is to really be thoughtful about, well, what questions am I going to ask? And one of my favorite general questions, and also to get the founders to open up, right? Because a founder comes into a pitch session and they want a check. Now, better founders also realize that all checks are not created equal. You know, you really want to care about the quality of who you're taking money from. But, you know, the main goal is they want an investment. And so they're very focused. And so you want to really get them to open up and tell you what's really going on at their business. So one of my favorite questions is, you know, founder will say something about their business and I'll just say, like, wow, that's so interesting. Can you tell me more about that? Or how did you figure that out? Or I'd love to understand that better. Can you dig in a little more? So open-ended questions like that, but also with the right tone. So it's friendly so that you encourage trust and candor, right? So you really can get people talking and you uncover all kinds of things that you might not have understood otherwise. Because don't forget, a pitch, you've got 10 minutes and then 10 minutes for questions, right? And at that point, we decide, which is pretty standard in early stage investing. And then the partners meet and decide, do we want to go to the next step? And so you've got to accomplish a lot in 10 minutes.
Yeah. So then is it just experience? And then, as you said, you're newer to this. So how are you handling that balance of your own curiosity and leaning on the expertise or the questions of those others that you're working with? How are you working that?
Totally. And that's really important. And I think that's been a strategy for me throughout my career, which is to surround myself. Years ago, one of my favorite leaders at American Express, I had landed in a job where I had not done the job of all the people who were now going to report to me, right? So I really didn't know what was going on. And she said to me, Amy, you've got to surround yourself with people who know things that you don't know and who like to do the things that you don't like to do. And I think that's like some of the best advice I've ever gotten for my career. And so in thinking about whether I wanted to be part of Soundboard, one of the things that really impressed me was the diversity of the people on the board. So there are other investors, there are engineers, there are scientists, there are people from retail, from packaged goods, people who have been franchise owners, people who have been entrepreneurs themselves, designers, product marketers. So an incredibly diverse group of people who bring skills and expertise. You know, they're patent experts to people who have the expertise that I don't have, right? And what I bring is, and we're all very curious, we ask a lot of questions. I bring my own perspective on marketing, on leadership, on digital transformation, and on talent, you know, helping to assess the talent, which have all been part of my roles, either explicitly or implicitly. But it's that I really rely on the expertise of others and listen to the questions they ask as much as I listen to the answers that a founder might give.
Have there been some particularly insightful questions that founders have asked of your team that have resonated with you?
I'll have to think about that one. Nothing's occurring to me immediately.
And I realize there's kind of the whole boot camp run up to it to be able to do that effectively. But it's like, you know, you've got this pressure and you keep doing all these pitches. And to get to the point that you can do it well, I'm sure it takes some practice.
It does. And I think really better founders, I guess in answer to your question, better founders really understand that when you take money from an investor, you're not just getting the money, you're getting their involvement or maybe not. They may take a seat on the board and be the person who fires you one day. But we, at least our philosophy is we want to also bring our expertise and mentorship and knowledge to the table, not just a check and not just door opening. Although we do a lot of that also. It's really important to, if you're investing at the early stage, helping the founder get business is critical. But I think the better founders and the more experienced ones understand this and they're doing a due diligence on who they're thinking of taking money from. And that would involve a whole series of questions to understand how the investors work with them, expectations, what else do they bring to the table? As if I were a founder, I would ask, tell me a little bit about some of your recent experiences working with some of your other portfolio companies and how you've helped them out. Tell me about a situation when another portfolio founder, you know, when the market changed and they almost had the rug pulled out from under them, what was your reaction and were you able to step in and help them? I would characterize those as tell me a story, not what would you do? Because what would you do questions a lot of times don't get you to the truth. But say, tell me about a time when one of your other founders ran into a predicament and were you able to help him out? Like, what happened? I think that is a very productive question for a founder to ask a potential investor before accepting the check. or these days, the wire transfer. There are no more checks.
Has there been anything this new venture has taught you about questions that all of your other previous experience hadn't taught you, or maybe this is just validated, but is there anything new that you've learned about questions as a result of going in this new direction?
Yeah, I think being an early stage investor has really validated for me how asking the right questions the right way at the right time can often be more a determinant of your success than being the person to raise their hand and come up with the answer, which of course is the exact opposite of what we're taught, at least in the education process in this country, which is, think about it, from our earliest years in the schools, we're taught, give an answer, get an A, not ask a question, get an A. And so it's validated that the question can have a bigger impact on success and failure. And I think now, at least for me personally, I'm working on so many things where I don't really know the answers. And so it's my ability to ask questions and puzzle things through that gets me to the answers.
What do you think might be a personal boot camp that somebody could do that could help build that experience? Or just how does somebody develop that experience apart from going through the years of C-suite experience that you've done?
I mean, if you're going to do it, I think on your own, my approach to learning and development these days is, although I teach in a formal program, it's less about taking classes and going to a boot camp and more. I run, I guess my personal boot camp is I tap into my network for help. Hmm. And so if you were an individual seeking to improve your ability to ask, you know, what Warren Berger calls beautiful questions and appreciate what that means, one thing you could do is maybe engage a personal advisor. You know, more and more people, at least senior people, are establishing their personal advisory boards. I have an informal board, not a formal board. I don't like formal structures, but there's a group of people who I will reach out to. And so you can engage a personal advisor and say, look, I'm really looking to build, to get better at this. You know, be willing to get candid feedback and then practice, practice, practice. A great time to practice that's incredibly revelatory is, and this is something that we did that we spent time on in my class at Columbia, is, you know, my students, they all want to be advocates for bringing new technologies into the organizations. And whether it's, or new business practices, new something, they're all advocating for change. And whether it's a startup or a mid-sized firm or a big company, a lot of the issues are the same, right? It's people struggle with change for lots of reasons. And you always encounter resistance. I say, if there's not resistance, you're not pushing hard enough. Something to do that may require you to tie that proverbial string around your finger so you remember to do it is when you run into resistance, a resistor, as opposed to doing what a lot of people do, which is trying to convince them while they're wrong, just pause, catch your breath, and ask a question. Ask, wow, I'd love to understand more where you're coming from. Could we just, you know, walk through it, because I want to appreciate what you're trying to do and why you're uncomfortable with this. So can you help me understand your perspective better? And it really takes down the temperature, number one. Number two, a lot of times you find out, you could find out you're not as far apart as you thought you would. And even better, oftentimes that person who you see as, you know, the enemy, they're really tough resistant. They actually are trying to tell you something. But unless you ask a few questions, you're not going to get below that emotional level of they're trying to stop me.
Gotcha.
You know, so that's a great time to practice. And I'm sure for many people, it comes up multiple times during the week, whether with family, whether with friends, in the workplace, that before you start saying why you're wrong, stop and try to learn more with a good question.
As a practical exercise if you just did a weekly check-in at the end of the week? Mm-hmm. How did I do? Did I do this three times? There were three specific times that I did it. And for the first few weeks, you're going to keep forgetting. And then you get to the end of your week and you're like, oh, dang, I forgot to ask. Or I forgot to do that. But at least
it's building muscle power. And, you know, our brains and our central nervous systems are wired to stop us from doing this. You know, we feel attacked.
Right.
Our whole system is conditioned to push back. And so you're fighting against something that's physiologically wired into us. But it's like exercise. If you haven't worked out in a year or in years, it's gonna be messy, maybe for the first couple of months, but you keep trying. And it's amazing how big a difference it makes to just ask a good question that demonstrates to somebody who, you know, really disagrees with something that's very important to you. If you can stop the pushback game and authentically and sincerely ask a question that demonstrates that you honestly want to understand better where they're coming from. Because if you do it in a superficial, phony way, that's worse. That will show right through. So you have to authentically want to understand where the other person is coming from and reflect that in your question. And it makes a massive difference in your ability to get what you want, and you'll feel better.
So let's take this opportunity, whether we choose to use that as the example or another example. What do you think makes for a good question?
Yeah, I think open-ended. I think questions that truly invite people in to tell you what they think or feel or believe. I can give you lots of examples, but I was thinking about this morning in advance of our call. And I know one of the things you wanted to talk about potentially was like, what are some of the worst questions you've heard? So this may be a good example. So a question I really think is ineffective and always discourage people from asking is, you're interviewing a candidate for a job in your organization, and there's a real tendency to, you know, you're thinking about, well, what are the key requirements? What do I really need from this person? And so you'll ask them, what would you do about XYZ? And I think that's a terrible question, because assuming you're interviewing a smart person, they know what the right answer is, and they will tell you what they would do, but that may have nothing to do with what they did do when faced with a similar situation. So a good question in that case would be, take me to a time when you had to do ABC. And let's imagine we're like in the room together and I'm watching you. You know, I'm invisible, of course, but I'm watching you. Help me understand what you did, what you felt and what you thought, and how did you actually handle that situation? So, and it's amazing that people really struggle to frame questions that way. And people really struggle to answer those questions. Not because they don't have the answers, but they're so unaccustomed to them. And also, we're so trained, at least in the corporate world, to always say we, not I. It's very hard to separate out. Like, this time, you can be really self-centered, and we want you to say I. And so it's a very directed question, but you get the person to open up, and you actually understand, well, how do they operate under scenarios that are really relevant in this office versus the what would you do's are speculative. Another one I really hate, which is the undoing of many great innovations, is, you know, innovation product leader has an incredible idea, validated, market some good initial user research, a good hypothetical business case, although, you know, everything's going to be wrong in the end, so you shouldn't get too hung up on it because you're really early now. They go to CFO to get a little bit of money to build a prototype. And the reaction from the finance team is, well, show me the ROI first. Now, that is an absurd question to ask at the early stage of something when you have no metrics. And so then what people do is they make matters worse by by taking cherry picking metrics from some other situations that everybody's comfortable with, but really have no relevance to the innovation. So I always tell people when I talk to clients and colleagues who are in internal roles in the companies or selling to a startup, selling a product, you know, B2B. So they're dealing with big companies. You don't answer that question. You cannot, do not pretend that you have an ROI, because you're just going to kill the innovation. A better question is, what metrics should we consider that would be appropriate to helping us understand the potential for this idea that would make us feel good about this tiny little investment you want to make for a prototype? Because if you want $10,000 or $20,000 for a prototype and maybe some friendly user tests, the ROI can be from learning. You're not going to get an ROI on that in the traditional sense. You're not going to generate a profit. So I think we're locked into a mode of questioning that is, those questions might work in certain situations, but they are actually quite counterproductive when they're applied in other situations.
It gets me thinking on, I'd love to charitable judgment on myself, think that I would have the courage to do it. But if you're sitting in an interview and you get a question like your first one, or you're trying, you know, you're struggling or you're fighting to get some funding for your project, and as you were talking about, in those conversations to say, thank you for the question. Can we rephrase it? Could we look at this question? That to me, if I was sitting across from the interview table and I asked the initial question and somebody in the, whoever I was interviewing said, I hear your question. I understand it. This is what I would propose as perhaps another question. What do you think? Could we go down that path? That to me would make a remarkable conversation. I would always remember that interview from the thoughtfulness of it.
Because that shows critical thinking,
right?
Which is a highly undervalued and essential skill in today's world, which depends on, it's very much wrapped around asking questions.
Yeah.
So it shows that you're being really thoughtful. It also is great strategically if you can't answer the question, but you're able to very gracefully say, well, let me come at this. Yeah, I hear what you're saying, and I'd love to come at it from a slightly different angle. But again, you have to be genuine and authentic and want to meet the needs of the interviewer. It's not a self-serving dodge, which again, will be seen right through.
Yeah, I don't want to promote the evasion. That's not what this is about. This is about...
No, but I love the idea of, I would definitely remember that candidate, and it does open the door. It could open the door to really good conversation, and that's what you want in an interview or a founder speaking to an investor. You want to establish a basis for trust and credibility. Either you're credible enough to be hired because I feel you can help my team be successful, or you're credible as a founder so that I know even though every single assumption you're making right now is probably wrong, I have the confidence that you will pull through and figure it out.
I love that idea for the community of listeners that we have that are here for better questions and trying to up their game. To find ways when they're asked questions, how can they bring the entire questioning game in the conversation up another level? If we build this, as you were saying, build the muscle where we are continually seeking to ask better questions and just build that ecosystem, then I would think it would look something like that, or we are trying to banter back and forth
a little bit to get to the better questions. Yeah, it's being asking better questions, I think, depends upon being better prepared, right? So if you go into, you know, it's like death to go to a job interview and not have good, you know, you're expected to ask questions. But I think too often people don't take that seriously enough. They don't really dig into what's the history of this company? What's the culture? What's it really like to work here? They ask the questions that everybody asks. So I think preparation, like really doing your homework, say, like, what do I really want to understand better about this opportunity? Or if I'm a founder, what do I really want to understand better about working with these investors? Or do I want to use the opportunity of this call, this pitch session or diligence to ask them their advice about something? And can I be candid about it? So I think the preparation matters a lot. But I'll tell you about something we did in my class at Columbia, which I think made a very big impact on my students. And it took about half an hour. I had assigned to my students a few chapters of Warren Berger's book, More Beautiful. The whole course is built around how do you become an effective advocate for change? So imagine these are a group of technology leaders. They're middle to upper management. Although I think we're all now technology leaders, but these people are in technology functions and they're advocating for change. And today with AI, all the issues around cyber risk management, technology is embedded in everything we're doing and has to go from being a function that's viewed as just taking orders from everybody to they're actually driving the show in a lot of companies and not just software companies. So we did this exercise, which actually I learned from a friend of mine who's the CEO of a very successful innovation consultancy. He has this meeting every week with his team, which he calls the Einstein meeting, where all people are allowed to do during the meeting is ask questions. They spend 55 minutes asking questions, and that's all they're allowed to do. So we didn't have that much time, and my group was wired a little differently. So I structured an exercise where we had about 22, 25 people in the class. We did this on Zoom. It's a virtual class, where one person stated a problem and then he popcorned to somebody else in the class. So they popcorned around them until everybody went. Every other person was only allowed to ask a question. And so, and modeled on the kinds of questions that Berger suggests are the beautiful questions. So why can't you, or how might you, or you know, questions, these very open-ended questions that get people thinking. And we went around the room. And so maybe it took like 20 or 25 minutes. And it was amazing because, first of all, the whole room became very calm. So it really affected the dynamic of the room. And it provided to the person who stated the problem up front so many ideas about how to think about his problem, because he posed like a real business problem. So many new ideas and insights came up just from the questions. And it got people to realize like, wow, asking questions is really powerful and is something worth taking the time to do. So if you lead a team or if you're in a group of people, even an exercise as simple as that can help really bring to life the power of asking questions before jumping to answers. And some of my students said it really changed how they go about building relationships with people. Like it had just that one, you know, 20, 25 minute exercise had a profound impact because it was such a powerful demonstration of why questions are such an important and underutilized behavior.
That exercise, I've done something similar. It seems like there's a somatic response to it, that the room just becomes more expansive.
Yes.
Right. Instead of driving down to try to, you know, go towards one solution, it's boom, it just everything opens up.
And it opens up. And I think at first people were a little uncomfortable. I mean, it's different.
Right.
And then at the end, I said, well, I like to be provocative in a helpful way. You know, I never do anything. I am not a business as usual person. If you want business as usual, you know, I'm the wrong person to call. So I like to be provocative in a way that gets people thinking. And so at first, I've got like 25 pairs of eyeballs staring at me on the screen. And at the end, I asked people how it felt. And it was, I don't have my notes here, so I have, but it was incredibly, it really was mindset shifting.
Please take 2 seconds to click the follow or subscribe button on your podcast player. You can set it once and forget tracking down each weekly episode. This makes your life easier and signals to the algorithms that the show should be recommended to other listeners. A simple act that can have an outsized positive impact on others. When you were talking about the interview question and asking someone what they did and how it felt, you'd asked or you brought that factor in. And then as you mention it here, how do we incorporate that into our questions, into our thinking? Because we here in the Western world, we are just so cerebral. Everything is in our brains, and it's this is only what I think, and that is first and foremost. And I'm not driving towards super mushy stuff, but it's I think that there's an element there. So how do you think about that feeling or that component of us and bringing that into the workplace and doing the work that you've been doing?
Yeah. First of all, I think part of the problem today, and I'm in the business of helping leaders enable change in their organizations. And I think because coming out of my own experience, I'd say earlier in my career, the focus was, I've got the business case, I've got the market research, I've got the data. Why isn't everybody saying yes and jumping up and down? Well, because change is very emotional. And there, especially now with AI, where people are fearing for the loss of their jobs, where we're watching what's happening in the government, where every week we're reading about another 10,000 person layoff in one of the big tech companies, there's fear. And even if it's not a job loss, how is this change going to affect my career and what happens to me and my ability to pay my mortgage and send my child to college? I mean, these are real fears. This is not irrational. So I think we've got to come around and acknowledge the emotion. And getting back to earlier in this conversation, we talked about resistance. Resistance can be emotionally driven, or it can come from misunderstanding, miscommunication. So I think the starting point is to be, you have to build trust. It's very hard to go up to somebody who you don't know that well, or you don't have a strong relationship with, or maybe not a good relationship, and say, like, how do you feel? How are you feeling about XYZ? That's probably not going to be the most constructive question. I think what I would recommend, start by observing. You know, you can listen. We listen. We don't just listen with our ears. We listen with our eyes, too. We listen with our noses. We say, I mean, we have 5 senses. So listen with your eyes to gather some basic insight about what's going on. And then you can build towards potentially a conversation. But the questions may be inside your head. They say, you know, why does Sally seem so upset at the meetings? And, you know, you have to start to listen. And I think listening goes hand in hand. It's a really important part of being an effective question asker. Think about it. If you just pound people with questions, even if they're Warren Berger's beautiful questions, that is not going to be very helpful. It's questioning blended with listening, but listening with all your senses, that can be helpful to deepening your understanding. I mean, because that's why we ask questions, to understand. Some people ask questions to antagonize. That's not my school of thought, right? It's asking questions because you're genuinely curious and you want to understand. That won't get you very far if you're also not listening, being like a full circle listener.
So let's talk a little bit about change and the role that questions play in that. I think that we're on track for that piece of the conversation based on where we're at. As you are engaging with a company and helping them think through change, how do questions play a role in that process?
I'll start specific and go a little broad. So a potential client approached me last week. And they asked me if I could create for them a workshop on change because they want to double in size in N-years, which everybody wants to, everybody seems to want to double in size these days. And they want to bring their 60 top leaders together to help enable them to be better change leaders and to really give them some actionable approaches that they could begin to implement like on Monday morning. So the first thing I did was I asked, well, first I did my homework. So I listened by doing some research on a company to understand where they were coming from, but then basic questions, who's going to be there? What's their mindset about learning? Is this a curious organization? How would you describe the culture? So getting enough of a frame it, right, to be very relevant to what it is. So I could figure out, first of all, can I solve their problem? And second of all, if I can, let me ask the questions that will help me, you know, kind of put enough dimensions around this so I can design something that would be useful and relevant for them. But then you get into what role do questions play in change? I think a tremendous role. If you think about the old rules of change management, which go back to Cotter's work now, literally in the last century, it was all change management was designed around the assumption that you did lots of top-down communications. Now, first of all, it presumed a hierarchical organization structure.
Yeah.
And you could drive the change through top-down, sort of one-way communications. And you could kind of modulate your pace. You control the timing, right? So think about now. People, AI disruption, to say like, no, you don't control the pace. We are in a remote hybrid world with as many as six generations present in the workforce. And, you know, people just don't take orders anymore. I know you were in the armed services. In the average workplace today, where you've got, say, boomers, Gen Z, and millennials, and Gen Alphas in their first job, people just don't listen. Gen Z, a very low percentage of Gen Z even aspire to be in upper management. They want to hit the ground running and make their impact now. So the old assumptions of change management that you just communicated top to bottom and people listened were designed for a world of a much more homogeneous workforce in terms of demographics, where people were on site to be pulled together for town halls and where you controlled the pace. Those rules don't exist anymore. So today, engaging people throughout the workforce and thinking about how do the networks of influence operate in my workforce and how do I not just communicate, but how do I take action through those to have people feel they are part of the change and they're driving it versus having change happen to them. So it becomes really important and I think an essential everyday behavior, but you have to rid yourself, you, people at the top level, people running, you know, transformation offices, I would advise them to rid themselves of the assumption that they're just going to tell people what to do and that they're in control of the timing. So you have to set aside some of those beliefs and adopt a whole new set of behaviors about how do I really accomplish this change? And it's going to be through coalitions up and down the organization, by tapping into networks instead of hierarchies, and by getting people across multiple generations to work together. And there, questions would play a very big role because it's building understanding starts with asking questions, right?
Yes. Just thinking on that multi-generational problem set. Yeah. And if you're a massive company like some of those that you've worked for, that smaller companies, small to mid-sized companies, I'm like, okay, it seems like that could be manageable. But for the amount of, and the bigger companies spread across the globe, that would be a daunting task. I'm glad there's folks like yourself with that experience.
I think even for a small company that's multi-generational, we have to change the way we think about change and how we relate to each other and respect difference. And I think the dispersion of the workforce, yes, definitely makes it harder because then you have the normal cultural differences. You have time zones. Now, I had, when I was at a city in particular, a very geographically diverse group. So they were all in the U.S., but came from vastly different cultures.
Gotcha.
I had a Tiananmen Square defector on my team. I had people from Turkey, from Germany, from India, really from all over the U.S., which itself is pretty culturally diverse. And so understanding those differences has always been a factor in many companies. But now you have, so the multi-generational, I think it's stopping to understand, even if you're co-located, you know, the boomer who would rather sit down maybe in a meeting and talk to people seems like a time waster to the Gen Z who goes like, well, why don't we just put it on Slack?
Right.
And that's just one tiny example. And I think that's something that all companies are going to have to reckon with if they want to truly have the best talent and not continue to discount the wisdom that boomers bring to the table.
You had mentioned the coalition building and some of these other mechanisms. How does fostering curiosity and questions play a role going through that?
When I talk about coalition building, and I certainly saw this as an innovator in the corporate world, and you can also see this even if you look at the history of social movements, that the best way, I think, to get meaningful change going is to start with that small group of passionate, committed allies who believe in what you are trying to do. And they among themselves are not falling in love with their idea. They're constantly questioning themselves and reaching out for output, whether it's from potential customers or users, from experts, from people outside the company, not just inside. I think a lot of companies become very insular. They stop asking questions from the outside, or they ask them so late that the people they're asking don't want to tell them that their baby is ugly. So they don't get honest answers. So the timing of the questions become very important. So I think it helps you develop better. It helps you validate and improve upon whatever the changes that you're driving at. You have to constantly been asking questions of yourselves and questions of all the different constituencies who could bring value or constructively challenge what it is you're trying to do. Because you really don't know. You know, we're at a very early stage. You really don't know. And unfortunately, our intuition, we reach into our historical knowledge or our intuition to tell us what the answers are when we're dealing with something new. And if you're doing something really new, the history can actually mislead you, right? And I can think of lots of examples of this that we went through when my team was tasked with leading the digital transformation of Citi's credit card business. It was a $5 billion bottom line. So pretty important to the corporation. So a lot of people hovering over what was going on and making sure that we weren't going to blow up the business. And one of the biggest challenges in working with colleagues outside of my group was, you know, we'd bring forward something that we wanted to do, and the lens of people's deep and vast and actuarially precise knowledge of how things should be and how they always were had nothing to do with where we were going. And so asking questions can start to help you break through, because, you know, our own knowledge can really become an obstacle when we're trying to drive change. So getting to the other side of that requires that we question.
And that example, it seems to me that there's questions going out to understanding what the change is going to look like. We're leaning forward, trying to make some magic happen out here on this bleeding edge of things. But then as you're just talking about, as I'm imagining the people kind of breathing down your neck, then there's a set of questions that you're looking back at them asking to challenge their assumptions and the like. Is that a fair conclusion?
It's helping. It's opening people up to the possibility that what was past may not define what's going to happen in the future. And so it's really asking questions. I think in my team's case, it was, yeah, we asked a lot of questions of ourselves and then sought the answers. And early on would bring those answers forward to try to engage people more in the conversation. And when people see the possibility of success, they like to affiliate with it. So as soon as you start to show that glimmer of hope that you're onto something, you start to get, you know, it's that adoption curve, right? Yeah. So you think about the classic adoption curve. You're down here with your new idea and you've got this little band of allies who are really committed. And how do you get that tipping point? You need to present that glimmer of hope. And also people who oftentimes, the people who are challenging whatever the changes that you're trying to implement, they're coming from, they're under really strong pressure to hit goals. Resources are not abundant in the business world these days. They want to pay their mortgage. So they're coming from, you know, it gets back to fear and risk aversion. So they're not necessarily coming from, they're not coming from a bad place. I think most people have good intentions, want to do the right thing, and they want their business to be successful. So you've got to help lead people towards seeing what's possible and putting some evidence behind it. And I think where questions really plays a role when you're at that early stage also is in experimentation. So if you're at the early stage of proving out some new innovation concept or idea, a very good way to get started, and this is what happens in the startup world, people start doing rapid series of iterative experiments. And the experiments are all based on, you have a hypothesis, and the hypothesis has questions. So it's really a scientific methodology, although I am no scientist, but it's applying the same methodology that scientists use. You have a question, and that frames the hypothesis. So I think back to the very early days of commercializing the internet and banking and the credit card business. A lot of the business is driven by acquiring new customers and new cardholders. So the question was, what role can digital channels be effective to attract new customers? So in terms of the quality of the customers, the profile, the cost of booking the customers, the risk profile of the customers, the impact on the brand, on going out through those channels. So you have a whole series of questions. And those drive how you create your experiments. And as you go through those, you start to get learnings. You don't necessarily get answers right away, because many of your experiments will not yield the positive answer that you've been hoping for. And so then they trigger another experiment with a new set of questions. And so it's a constant cycle of questioning to drive your experiments, to get learning, and then to socialize that learning in the organization and to invite others in. So something that I recommend that I've done myself in the past is you bring people to the table who are skeptics and make them part of the process of, well, let's design the experiment. Not do you think it's a good idea or a bad idea? Let's design, we want to co-design the experiment and we want you to provide input to the experiment. That's really helpful. And in fact, thinking back to my venture fund, when we are in due diligence, we always have one person on the team who's a skeptic. Somebody who's not supportive of the idea of the investment, and they present their case as part of the decision of whether to invest or not. I love that aspect of our process. Because again, it promotes question asking and dialogue, and it helps people look at things differently.
So when you were starting out on that journey at Citi, trying to develop all this new business, so you really were starting out with getting all the people in the room or virtual room, and you're like, okay, let's figure out the questions that we're really going after. Is that to kind of develop that?
Yeah, we started being a very financially outcome-driven and risk-managed organization, right? When we're doing unsecured consumer loans. So it's all about the risk. Are you taking the right amount of risk so that enough risk so that people will extend payment, but not so much risk that they're not going to pay you back? And that's a very, you know, you're really threading a needle and on a business
sweet spot there, yeah.
That was generating billions of dollars of profit and had tens of millions of customers. You could not cost cut your way out of a problem. So we had a very disciplined process that we developed that started with what we'd look at the income statement or the balance sheet. And we would say, let's look at the line items and what aspects do we think that innovating around the digital experience could favorably impact those aspects, those financial drivers of the business. So, and then we would prioritize. Then say we would look inside, you know, I brought up customer acquisition. Let's talk about customer service, right? So customer service, big one. Okay, what role could digital channels play in customer service that could improve the customer relationship, lower costs, improve customer satisfaction, reduce attrition, increase people's usage of the card? So now you can see I'm breaking down each of those things I'm mentioning takes you to another series of questions and another set of experiments. Then you have to prioritize those.
Right.
And the prioritization is conversation with lots of questions, you know, a lot of what if questions. I think what if is a great opener for a question. So you design your whole methodology around asking questions, but they would ladder up to the big question of, in our case, what role does digital technology play in our business to benefit customers and shareholders? But you have to keep asking more and more questions, kinds of excavating down, and then that turns into real work. So that's why prioritization becomes really important. And where engaging your stakeholders becomes really important because you have legal implications, you have compliance implications, you have risk, you need design talent, you certainly need technology, you need data. So all of that, the coalition building and bringing people on board by listening to them and understanding where they're coming from and getting them excited about what you're doing becomes really important.
What about who you are in your experience? Do you think got you the job or the folks that said yes back in those days? Because as you said, there's lots of risk there and in all this uncertainty. We're post Y2K. We found out that the world did not end.
Yeah.
And a bright, shiny new world here. So what was it that folks were like, Amy is the right person for this job?
Yeah. So I can't get inside people's heads. But what sure. I think made me, at least at the outset, an appealing candidate to join Citi to lead the digital transformation was, frankly, I brought really great experience from American Express on card member experience. I've worked for great companies. American Express is the only large company I've worked for that truly, in my experience, put the card member at the center of the business. Really, for everything that's really important. But for digital, that idea of what we call customer centricity really impacts your success. And I'd like to think also my charm and whatever, but I don't know what else. And I really was passionate about doing it. I mean, I'm up for a challenge. I never take the easy path. In fact, when I took this job, my husband said, like, you don't know anything about technology. Why'd you get this job? I said, frankly, that's not exactly true. And it's not about the technology. It's about understanding the customer. And the technology is an enabler. It's an enabler because if you're not solving real people's real problems, you are not going to have a business. It doesn't matter how good the technology is. So then you might ask, well, how did you become a chief innovation officer? Which is a question I'm often asked. And I had a mentor who I met at Citi. He was an external consultant. We taught in one of our executive ed programs, and he was a globally respected and known expert on the disciplines of innovation. So I had never thought about innovation before. It was not in my personal dictionary. But as I got to know this gentleman, his name is Larry Keeley, he's retired now, I started to see innovation not as cool stuff, but as viable ways to solve real people's real problems, either incrementally or through disruption. And so I learned a lot from Larry, and he really encouraged me. He said, well, you should be a chief innovation officer. I said, well, what's that? And I asked the question. I didn't say, no, you're crazy. I said, what's that? And I was at a point in the credit card role where I was like feeling the itch to move on. And so I went and pitched it. And in the spirit of be careful what you ask for, you may get it. My management said yes. And I became one of the first global chief innovation officers over the consumer businesses for Citi, which was a great role, an unfortunate one to have heading into the financial crisis in 2008. Because innovation had become kind of a bad word at that point in financial services. So it was an experience I had for about a year and a half. But I learned a lot, and I definitely don't regret it. But it was, again, it was my curiosity. It was my willingness. I had an external network. I asked a question to find out more instead of shutting it down. I was crazy enough to pitch it, and then I went and did it.
What do you think about specifically on questions in challenging assumptions? You talked a little bit about the assumptions there. What about being intentional and not just, oh, I happen to be, you know, some spurious curiosity kind of thing, but what about being intentionally using questions in a systematic way to question assumptions?
I think it's a really good discipline to have. And I think sometimes we get into the mode of doing things a certain way. And, you know, the reason we do them that way may no longer exist. We might not even know why we do it that way. Right. And I've seen this many times in the different organizations that I've been involved in when people decide, you know, time to do some reengineering and process simplification, which is always good to relook at your processes. And oftentimes one of the best questions that's asked is, why are we doing it like this? And, or where did that assumption come from? And oftentimes it's just completely outmoded and needs revisiting. So I think that's a very worthwhile exercise. And certainly to my example before about ROI, I think in my experience as a corporate innovator, one of the big dangers to innovation is when we take financial assumptions, metrics that have been very robust and effective for an established business with years or decades of rearview mirror data to validate them. And we say, okay, this is the right metric for this new thing where customers' behavior may be completely different. And I saw many examples as we did the digital transformation where old assumptions about how to measure when they were, you know, the ROI being a big one, when we imposed them on new thinking, the new ideas were destroyed, and not because they didn't have merit, but because we were picking up the wrong lens and nobody challenged why that was the right lens.
Mm. One of my favorite questions I got from a gentleman named Frank Blake, and his question was, what is the metric's fatal flaw? And so anytime anybody's talking about metrics, I'm like, okay, do you know what this is actually driving? What behavior, what culture it's driving? So do we know the downside of what's happening by choosing this number?
And what was his answer?
No. It was his question out and saying that this is a great question. And so now as I encounter folks and have conversations and they talk about their metrics, that's ringing through my head. And if they have no idea, then it's worth a conversation to say, what is it? Because otherwise you think it's, you know, you're getting some result, but there may be other elements here that you're not aware of. And it may, as you encountered, it may be time to retire that or to modify it.
No, I think that's right. And there's so many examples of that in the corporate world where people are under pressure to deliver near-term results. And in some cases that, you know, think back to Enron that led to criminal activity. So yeah. I think you always have to take some time to contemplate the unintended consequences. And looking at one metric by itself can introduce all kinds of risks to your business. So looking holistically at how to all the levers, you know, if I push this button, I push this down, what's popping up? And I think some businesses have become so complex and their accounting systems may not even be set up to understand those interconnections. Data may be so siloed that you can't get at the answers. Years ago, I was asked a very simple question early in my tenure on the digital work, which was, when people go online, what happens to call volume? Now, that's a very reasonable question.
Yeah.
You know, looking back, such an obvious question that people want to know. And it turned out that at least at that point, and I bet this is still the case in lots of companies, that data on calls was in this operational data silo that was never envisioned to be used for deep analytics or certainly cross-channel analytics. Well, there was no digital channel when that call volume silo was built. It could tell you the numbers of calls, the lengths of the calls, the time of day of the call. So lots of useful data about the calls, but it could not tell you this. So we actually had a part-time person for a few months. We had tick sheets and they were counting. We did a manual analysis of 1,000 calls, whatever, you know, some small sample, just to try to get a grip on what was happening. So there was no way to answer the question. And companies that don't have activity-based costing accounting systems cannot, if you have a business with multiple products, which we had, we had different card products and each card product had a product manager and they own the P&L for that product. If you could not incent people differently, if we figured out that it was really beneficial to the customer and to the shareholder to invest in encouraging people to service their accounts online, we could not incent product managers to do that because we could not measure. It was not built into our accounting systems. We just took a flat operational cost number and allocated it to everybody. There was no way to create the incentive because the infrastructure never anticipated that, was not set up to do that. And it was a big work effort to get there. So it had to be prioritized. So yeah, the question of what do we measure is definitely one that I think in this day and age is a really important one to revisit. And I think leaders who jump to the assumption that they just roll forward the metrics they've always used are probably missing opportunity and probably creating risks that they can't see yet.
Since you're all about change and innovation, how do you see questions playing a role in sparking insights? I'm really curious about the Venn diagram of questions and insights.
To me, questions are the door opener to getting insights. And so it's, first of all, occurring to you that you should ask the question and then going and asking. And it's funny, I want to talk for a minute about qualitative insight gathering. So asking questions one-to-one or in small groups versus surveys. So a lot of times I will talk to clients or colleagues, potential clients, and we're talking, we're ruminating about something we want to learn more about. And the answer is, well, we'll do a survey. Or we know they're very much less and less a fan of big surveys as the source of truth, especially these days, because there's known bias in who responds to surveys. There's channel bias if you go online versus phone. Who wants to go to a focus group facility anymore? There's a lot of issues with survey data. And so it could be directionally useful, but as I said, it's rarely the source of truth. I'm a much bigger believer in a large handful or maybe a dozen, even two dozen, if you have to, well-structured interviews where you're speaking to people of interest for whatever it is you want to learn about, and you're asking them great questions. Not leading the witness, trying to really get at not just what they feel rationally and why, but how they feel. What brought them to have these opinions or beliefs? So I think to me, asking questions, especially, you know, again, to people of interest in small groups or even one-to-one, leads you to one of the most powerful sources of insight, but also observation paired with asking. So to my point earlier about when we listen with all of our senses and we may be asking a question in our head that we're not articulating out of our mouths, but we're looking around for the answer. In 2010, the financial crisis was heavily underway. I was doing some ethnographic research and we did in-home interviews with people in our target market. I was at E-Trade at that point. And we wanted to understand how people were. The question was, how are people managing their financial lives in the context of dealing with all the fallout from the financial crisis and going into people's homes or their place of business? You learn so much more. You can learn things from observing and being in their space that you would never get just from verbal questioning. So I think the combination of the two, like we would ask people, show us the place. We'd love to see the place in your home where you pay your bills and manage your money. And just seeing the setup, are things filed or is it a big mess in a paper bag? And why is it set up like that? And help me understand how you stay organized with this. Tell me about your system, but then show me your system.
Yeah.
So it gets you around the what would you do dilemma. So I think it's the greatest. So I can't imagine getting insight without asking questions. But again, of parties of interest and the kinds of questions that we've been talking about, open questions that really invite people in to share their thoughts, beliefs, and feelings with you.
Yeah, I was just listening to a Diary of a CEO podcast about finances. And it was a bunch of different folks on the round table. And so just freshly reminded this morning of, and I'm sure it happens at the corporate side, but specifically the individual side, just all of the emotion that goes into a personal finances. If you're doing well, then it's almost easy. But if you're not, or if things are a struggle, there's just all of the extra fears, all of the other stuff that gets piled on, in addition to making sure that the checkbook is balanced. But there's a lot of fears and all the rest.
You'd be amazed, though. I mean, one of the reasons that I wanted to go, that I chose to pursue a career in the financial services sector, is that I was at Wharton, so I had lots of options to interview at all kinds of companies. And I just came to the conclusion that, you know, like money will never run out of gas. People and their money will always be interesting and problematic. And I can tell you, people's attitudes and fears do not correlate to their wealth status. So I've talked to women with high six-figure incomes who fear ending up homeless. I've talked to people of relatively modest incomes who cannot tell you what the balance is in their checking account. They don't know what they've got, or they have no idea what their interest rate is. So money is so emotional. And I think for most people, and I'm sure we can think of people in the public eye who are not like this, but for most people, money is a means to an end. It is not the end. Yeah. So there are emotional things they want to satisfy. They want to provide a home for their family or the people they care about. They want to make sure their children, if they have them, are educated. They want stability. They want to have a good retirement, although they can't quite tell you what that means. People's attitudes are very emotionally grounded. But yes, it is endlessly interesting. And yes, has not changed, has not become more rational in my experience over the time I've spent in financial services. It's still my favorite sector to go back to. even during the financial crisis, when home values were plummeting, I interviewed people who still felt personal real estate was the best investment. And now maybe they were thinking, well, because the value will come back up. But even then, when residential real estate was really in a hole, I remember how much the value of our home went down, because it's the American dream to own a home, and because you can touch it. There's something emotional about you can go and touch that brick wall and it's yours. It's very emotional. That was not about values going up. It was about the emotion of being able to touch it.
That is a amazing insight to have about a potential career or a factor as you're looking to, oh, what in the world? What are all the things that I could do? And to think about, yeah, money and humanity. Yeah, there's always going to be some work and some interesting things that surrounding that topic.
It's not run out of challenges. And I think now we think about it with healthcare costs devouring people's wallets, the issues are going to become more severe, because the things that drive people into financial distress in this country are, even for most families, a $400 auto repair can create, you know, an unexpected medical bill, a job loss, a death in the family. So all of these non-controllables, and on the healthcare side, that's going to become a bigger factor. So yeah, money and health, very intricately linked, raising all kinds of new questions and opportunities for innovation.
You had mentioned early on about not being the cookie cutter person and wanting to, my terms, kind of be out there on the edges a little bit, mixing things up. How has that served you?
Sometimes well, and sometimes not so well.
Yes, there's got to be a little bit of yin and yang, I'm sure.
Yeah. At one point, one of my CEOs, who I'm still very good friends with, we were reflecting on the past. And he said, you know, Amy, at one point, half your colleagues wanted you dead. And not literally, like these days, that's a dangerous thing to say, right? But because I was provocative. And I don't know what it is about me, and I can't trace it to a particular thing. But I was always more attracted to figuring out what's next than to maintaining the status quo. To me, the status quo is just being in a maintain role would be so boring. If you said to me, just run this and don't mess it up. Because I'm always just looking for, what can we do about this? Or I just see opportunity. And maybe it goes back to, I went to this very interesting, like a progressive experimental high school in New York City. It's actually a New York City public school that's no longer around. It's called John Dewey High School. Spike Lee was a classmate of mine. He's in my yearbook. Wow. A little bit of fun trivia.
Looks
exactly like Spike, except with more hair. But it was basically like a pass-fail system, a lot of open classroom, a lot of access to your teachers outside of classroom, all built on the education philosophy of John Dewey, which you may be familiar, is very much around critical thinking and curiosity and encouraging exploration and learning. So maybe that I don't know if I went there with that wiring. It was just my parents wanted to send us there because they didn't like the school we were zoned for. And this was a school that anyone in Brooklyn, I'm from Brooklyn, if you can't tell from my accent, anyone in Brooklyn could go there. So it may have been just to get us out of district, but that probably had a really big impact on me. But I don't know what made me that way. It's just where I go. We all gravitate to different things.
Right. Well, probably what's more curious to me is how you've maintained it. Because you went into the corporate world and financial world where there's all this risk. Oh no, we're going to lose money. And it seems to me, sitting in the cheap seats, that would be an environment that would seek to stifle that because it would be risk adverse. But
I won't talk about the companies on the dark side of my career, But speaking to, it doesn't do you any good. But as I said about American Express, the focus at American Express on really putting the card member at the center was a great environment for someone like me. Because we went where the customer wanted us to go, which doesn't mean you do for the customer whatever they ask for, because customers also want, especially a financial company, they want a stable company. So they may not get up in the morning and say, we want you to make your analyst targets, but actually it matters to them. So I think that was a great environment for me. And that was kind of dumb. There's a whole story behind that, but it was not systematically like I targeted American Express, right? It was my circumstances that sort of led me there. And then Citi, which initially had kind of a pointy elbow reputation when I got the call from the headhunter, and I had that, you know, reputation of being a little sharp elbowed. And I'm like, oh, this would be a terrible place for me. Very different culture than American Express. But a friend of mine who's a career coach said, you know, Amy, you should always take the call and go on the interview and ask and learn about it, ask questions. And I went and I was like, wow, this isn't like the stereotypes, because the particular people who wanted to bring me on board, we had enough shared values and shared interests that it worked for a long time. I had some good experiences, and I guess I'm pretty resilient. So I'm not a person who accepts setbacks very well. I keep going. But I am willing to try new things. I'm teaching at Columbia now, and I just teach this one course, strategic advocacy. And it came about because someone who reached out to me cold on LinkedIn about 10 years ago became the associate program director for the program I teach in. We were in touch periodically every year or two, meet for a cup of coffee, because we had a lot of common interests. And he called me and he said, you know, I'm here in this job. Would you be interested in teaching this course? It's called Strategic Advocacy. And I'm like, what the hell is that? And he read the description. I'm like, wow, that sounds just like me. And I was willing to jump in to the deep end of the pool. It's a little crazy because I did not fully appreciate what it means to get a course to stand up on its feet for the first time. So I worked pretty hard. I think that's another thing. I work hard for what I want. I work hard for what I think is the right thing for me. And I try to stay true to myself and what matters to me. It's nothing special. It's just I'm very principled.
Well, it seems like it's been working for you pretty well. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's been okay. I have, you know, life, careers, life, everything is a series of ups and downs. And you have to celebrate the highs. And whenever I see an announcement of someone in my life on LinkedIn about some new opportunity, I always say, enjoy the moment. You know, celebrate this moment, because they don't happen every day. And I think they help give me the gas in the tank to believe in myself and keep going when you hit the low points.
So let me foot stomp that just a moment then. So you have been intentional about celebrating. It won't be every time, I get that, but you have been intentional about pausing to celebrate. Is that something that
I try to?
Yeah.
Yeah, I try to.
Yeah.
I think it's really important. I think we're in a tough world where people are always being told, like, what do you need to do next? And stopping to just enjoy where you are is really important.
Well, along the lines of enjoying where you are, what are your right now questions or question that you're working with?
Right. Well, one of my right now questions, I probably have many, is I'm wondering why some of my best questions seem to come to me when I'm talking to my dog. But I've been thinking, you know, maybe it's because he listens and doesn't interrupt me. But yeah, I go for a long walk every morning with Mickey. I call Mickey a he. He's actually a she. I go to a long walk, and that's what some of my best questions occur to me, trying to figure out why that's the case.
Gotcha. And this is kind of a morning take Mickey out for
it's
a walk
first,
kind of thing?
You know, it's my morning ritual. First of all, Mickey needs the walk.
Yep.
So as a practical matter, if you have a dog, you got to get that dog out there.
Yep.
But also, I think walking is known to boost creativity. So it's a very good way, I think, for anybody to start the day is to go for a walk. It gets you going. It's calming. It's, as long as it's not raining or freezing out, in which case it's not calming. but on a nice day, it's just really good for your brain to go for a walk. It helps me think.
Yeah.
In a very untethered way.
Yeah. You're in good company because there's a lot of other big brain folks, successful folks that have embraced the walking culture and found it to be very, as you say, creative space. So that's beautiful.
Yeah, Mickey got me into it. I've had Mickey for 6.5 years. And I have to say, before her, I did not do a regular walk. So I'm forever grateful to her because she's got me to establish this habit, which is really, you know, obviously all kinds of benefits.
Yeah.
But great for thinking.
That's wonderful. Wonderful. Let's see, as we look towards wrapping up, we've covered a lot of ground, but I also know that you did a lot of preparation thinking through on questions. And are there any areas of questions that we didn't touch on that you're hoping to or excited to be able to touch on?
You know, we covered so much ground. And I said, just was like looking down at my notes. We covered a lot of ground. I think we hit everything I had in my notes and went way beyond.
Excellent.
So yes, you're a good questioner. You enjoyed the conversation and you definitely met my expectations. So.
Excellent. Woohoo. That's a beautiful thing. Where is the best place for folks to track you down and see the things that you're working on and the things that you're excited about?
Yeah, the best place to track me down is a couple of places. You can go to my website, which is amyradin.com. You can also reach out to me on LinkedIn, Amy Radin, R-A-D-I-N, at my website. You can sign up for my newsletter, or you can just shoot me a message in LinkedIn. I send a very short, very actionable newsletter every month called Uncommonly Pragmatic, which oftentimes deals with questions that I'm trying to answer. And definitely thought-provoking and designed to help people see things a little differently in a world where we all need to. So those are three contact points, and I hope your listeners will reach out.
Excellent. Well, Amy, thank you for the conversation. Thank you for saying yes. The things that I mentioned at the top are very impressive, and I'm grateful that questions have been a part of that, but also that you brought that conversation here for folks to be able to take and learn from and incorporate into their lives. So thank you. I appreciate it.
You know, really fun to be part of the conversation. I hope that your listeners enjoy it as much as I have.
Ken here. The conversation with Amy included so much wisdom. As I re-listened during post-production, I found so many one-liners that were almost throwaway lines, but were each worth their weight in gold. I've compiled 4 key takeaways and will share them with you in just a second. I wanted to share that I'm grateful for the newsletter subscribers who have signed up to the bi-monthly distribution from the Curated Questions homepage at curatedquestions.com. So while you're there, click on the link to record your right now question input, which may be included in an upcoming episode. Now, on to the takeaways. Number 1. Asking questions is more predictive of success than having answers. Amy's experience as an early stage investor validated a counterintuitive truth. Asking the right questions the right way at the right time is often a stronger determinant of success than being the person who raises their hand with the right answer. This directly contradicts Western education's give an answer, get an A conditioning. When working on multiple fronts where she doesn't know the answers, from AI implementation to new technology investments, her ability to ask questions and kind of puzzle things through gets her to solutions. The implication is profound. We've been rewarded for the wrong behavior. Focusing on the answer might have worked as schools sought to develop cogs for the Industrial Revolution, but it doesn't foster the cognitive flexibility required for the challenges of an AI-centric future where question-asking ability outperforms answer-providing ability. Question:
How would your career trajectory change if you spent the next year becoming known for asking brilliant questions rather than providing quick answers? Number two, the curiosity over convincing framework. When encountering resistance, which Amy notes means you're pushing hard enough, pause before trying to convince someone they're wrong. Instead, ask, "I'd love to understand more about where you're coming from. Could we walk through it? I want to appreciate what you're trying to do and what you're uncomfortable with about this. Can you help me understand your perspective better?" This isn't a manipulation tactic. It requires authenticity, wanting to understand. The physiological reality is that our nervous systems are wired to push back when we feel attacked. Building the muscle to ask genuine questions instead of defending your position is like exercise. Messy at first, but transformative with practice. Often, you discover you're not as far apart as you thought, or that the resistor is actually trying to tell you something valuable. Question: can you identify three times over the coming week when you could practice asking, "Help me understand your perspective, please," instead of explaining why someone is wrong? Number three, the structured skepticism strategy. This combines a couple of ideas Amy mentioned and that I wanted to ensure to include, and that's personal advisory boards and always having one person on the team who's a skeptic. Amy surrounds herself with people who know things she doesn't know and who like to do things she doesn't like to do. She maintains an informal personal advisory board of people she reaches out to for candid feedback and guidance. This principle extends to her investment work at Soundboard Venture Fund, where they've institutionalized productive dissent. When evaluating potential investments during due diligence, someone who's not supportive of the investment idea is included on the team. That person presents their case as part of the decision-making process. This isn't about being contrarian for its own sake. It's about deliberately creating space for the questions and perspectives that challenge assumptions. The combination of seeking diverse expertise and building in structured skepticism prevents groupthink and surfaces blind spots before they become costly mistakes. These concepts work on the personal and corporate levels. Question: who are the people in your network who know what you don't know, and how could you formally invite skeptical perspectives into your most important decisions? Number four, the Einstein meeting methodology. Amy learned this practice from an innovation consultancy CEO, a weekly meeting where people are only allowed to ask questions for 55 minutes. When she adapted this for her Columbia class, where one person stated a real business problem and everyone else could only ask open-ended, quote, beautiful questions such as, "Why can't you?" and "How might you?" the impact was profound. The vibe in the room became calm. The person with the problem received numerous new ideas and insights just from the questions themselves. Students reported it changed how they build relationships with people. The exercise was only 20 or 25 minutes, but it was a mindset shifting because it powerfully demonstrated why questions are such an important and underutilized behavior. I too have used this practice and learned the discipline of question-only conversation forces deeper thinking and reveals assumptions. Question: what would happen if you designed a regular meeting as question-only, where solutions are forbidden and curiosity is the only currency? Well, that's it. I know you had some of your own moments that particularly resonated with you, and I'd love to see them in the comments section of your particular podcast player. To those on the other side of the speaker, thank you for being here. Gratitude shout out to Beauty Pill for the show's music and producer Ben Ford for the technical help. This episode was recorded on Piscataway land. please engage with this episode in some manner. Download, follow, save, like, share, or comment about something that resonated. This action ensures we are engaging the questioning community, and it continues to grow. So until next time, keep questioning.